listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we get an update on events in Brazil and Venezuela from Tony Solo, who's watching events in the region from Managua, Nicaragua. Well, Tony, we've got the situation with Lula in Brazil certainly needs to be discussed, and also the various things that are happening in Venezuela, and the whole region seems to be popping with things. Paraguay's got presidential elections in 2 weeks, elections in Costa Rica. Let's start, though, with Lula and Brazil, because this is the B in BRICS. It's a big deal.
Yeah, I know, and it's a very important regional event because it brings home the fact that the regional elites, very like the elites in Europe, are completely subordinate to what amounts to an extremely counterproductive, self-destructive policy from the United States. Because, and if you, and yesterday I put up the Spanish text of Lula's speech before he went off to hand himself into the police. And what he says there is that it reminds me so much of something that a writer whom I'm not entirely enthusiastic about, but who did have some good insights, named George Orwell. And he wrote in his book about the Spanish Civil War, the truth goes on existing behind your back. And however much the elites may push down on the aspirations of the majority, those aspirations are going to keep kind of pushing up towards the light, because that's their only option. Mm-hmm. And so there's a line in Lula's speech where he quotes a little girl who said to him, the rich and powerful may be able to kill two or three roses, but they'll never stop the advent of the spring.
That's right.
And that's, you know, and that's, and it's like, and the United States, and the United States diplomacy, for, you know, if one can call it that these days, is like the, you know, to mix metaphors, perhaps, the little Dutch boy trying to stop the hole in the dike, you know, because there's absolutely no chance that the regional elites and their Western European and North American patrons are going to deny the majority of people in Latin America or Africa or anywhere else their aspirations to a decent life. It's just not going to happen.
That's right.
So what we're looking at is another example of elite stupidity, trying to, instead of reaching an accommodation that is viable for both sides, you know, this just reminds one of the wisdom of the Chinese and their insistence on win-win negotiations. And what the United States model is zero sum. We win, right. You lose.
Right.
And that, you know, that just doesn't work in today's world. It may have worked back in the days when the West had infinitely superior military technology enabling them to commit genocide against all the peoples of the majority world, but those days are gone.
Right.
And so what we're seeing now, and something that's interesting is the enormous disconnect between, I find it interesting, I don't know about you, Don, I just find it fascinating how Western corporate media are able to build up this massive disconnect between reality and their fantasy. So if you were to ask anybody in the West, in North America or Europe, just randomly, what do you think about events in Brazil? They'll say, oh, that corrupt politician Lula got sent to jail.
Right.
But the reality, if you look at what is the reality, you have hundreds of thousands, millions of people who recognize that the case against Lula da Silva in Brazil was completely baseless, no right. evidence, no proof,
right.
just suspicion, backed up by, initiated in fact, by a municipal level judge who was able to coerce a phony confession from somebody that he threw in jail as on preventive detention. And offered the incentive of, well, if you give me what I want, you can get out of jail.
Right. This sounds like an awful lot like a plea bargain here in the United States, which is their motive.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, and but what an indictment of American jurisprudence. And I use American in the, you know, in the sense of all the Americans.
Yeah, the regional, right.
And where does that jurisprudence come from? And there's a guy called Bruno Scarzini who I did a translation of his article about how events in Brazil have become a kind of template for the elites in order to impose their control on the region, albeit provisionally. And what he points out is that this jurisprudence is completely phony, and it's based on a complete manipulation by the elites, to the point where even the justices of the Supreme Court, in their deliberations on the last week's appeal by Lula for habeas corpus, because in Brazil the law is that the Constitution and the Criminal Code explicitly state that nobody should be imprisoned, nobody can be imprisoned, unless all their judicial options or possibilities of judicial review have been exhausted. And that's not the case in the case of Lula.
Yeah, it's not reviewable, really. All the reviews lead back to the original municipal level judge.
Right. Exactly. And
it's
so
ridiculous.
But if you look at that, if you look at the judgment, what half a dozen of the judges said was that, and it's important to bear in mind that Lula's case was accelerated. It was brought forward in the calendar of cases to be reviewed, because most left-wing, most progressive analysts in Brazil assumed that because the case was only scheduled to be reviewed by the Supreme Court long after the elections that are scheduled for July or early August, that Lula would be able to participate in the election campaign. But the Supreme Court took a political decision to bring that judgment, that review of the case forward, ahead of a couple of cases that were going to, in which they'd have to rule on whether the Brazilian constitution prevailed or not. In the sense that the Brazilian constitution stipulates that no one should be put in jail unless all their judicial options have been exhausted. And what Sergio Moro, the municipal level magistrate, has done with the connivance of his superior judicial authorities is put into preventive detention in a completely unconstitutional way potential witnesses in his corruption investigation. It's that coercive measure to an overwhelming degree that has made it possible for him to build a case against the various people that he's accusing in the accusation. But in the case of Lula, he has no evidence whatsoever, because the testimony of the person that he put into preventive detention and pressured to testify against Lula has been completely contradicted by subsequent events. The accusation was that Lula benefited from receiving a luxury apartment.
Right.
From this construction company, but the evidence that Sergio Moro, the investigating magistrate at municipal level, put forward was an unsigned bill of sale.
Right.
And then apart from that, this phony testimony from the executive director of a company that subsequently, in a civil case, they were the ones who were judicially identified as the owners of the property, right. Not Lula.
Right, and Lula didn't have occupancy of it either. It's like
never even spent a night there. He visited it once for maybe half an hour.
You know, like I have. You could go out on a Saturday in New York and visit, you know, 30 apartments.
Sure.
If that means, you know, I mean, I guess I could do like my dog does and take possession under the old-fashioned jungle way. But otherwise, it's impossible for me as a professional with 40 years experience in the title insurance business to imagine how just passing through gives you property rights. And about here is like Vonnegut with Cat's Cradle. It's like, it's insane. There's no cat, no cradle.
Right. So the people casually reviewing any reporting on the case will get a completely phony idea of what's happened in Brazil, because essentially it's the one of the final chapters in the soft coup that started back when was it 2015 against Dilma Rousseff.
Yep.
And that was carried through. And what is the object of that? The object of that is to make it impossible for progressive, to shut down all the institutional avenues, the electoral avenues, any possible institutional space for a progressive option supported by the majority of the Brazilian people. And one saw that when immediately prior to the Supreme Court judgment last week that infamously refused Lula da Silva his constitutional rights, going directly against, contravening directly the self-same Brazilian constitution of the Republic of Brazil. Immediately prior to that, a retired former head of the armed forces said, if Lula doesn't go to jail, there'll be a coup.
Yeah,
and then
right.
when the actual head of the armed forces was interviewed by a local media in Brazil and asked, you know, what do you think of that declaration by the former head of the armed forces? He said, oh, it's perfectly reasonable.
Wow.
And so, you know, and that was the context in which Lula has been jailed. So what? And so look at that in a regional. Let's step back and look at that in a broader context.
Let's look at the real broad context first, because there's this piece that you sent me the other day, and I pulled the site out of it that I sent back to you that I think tells the whole macro story. In 2014, the BRICS countries announced in Brazil an alternative financial system led by China and Russia. Today, Brazil is leading plans to sign a free trade agreement with the EU and to converge with the Pacific Alliance, the U.S.'s successor to the thing that got shot down, surrounding China, Trump killed.
Yeah.
So what they did basically, by removing Dilma Rousseff, they yanked Brazil out of the orbit of the BRICS, setting up a multipolar world, and made it one of the soldiers in line to establish a U.S., you know, hegemonic construct from Europe to Asia.
Yeah, and Bruno Scarsini, the author of that piece, and I sympathize a lot with his general point of view, and I think he doesn't give sufficient weight to the broader global context. And what are Argentina and Brazil really going to do? And what are the countries of the Pacific Alliance, Chile, Colombia, Mexico, principally, but also Peru? Chile, Peru, and Mexico that have signed up to the latest version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership,
right, TPP,
that was revived once the United States left.
Right.
But that's now led by Japan.
Right.
And all the signs are that, as you say, looking at it in this global macro level, all the signs are that Japan and those Asian countries are going to reach an accommodation. It may be a rocky road, but they're going to reach an accommodation with China.
Right.
Because why? Because the United States has opted for protectionism under Trump, because they know that they can't compete on a level playing field, on equal terms, with their major global competitors. They just can't. Of course they can't, because they've outsourced their years ago. They outsourced the power of their real economy. They outsourced that to China and other countries. So the real economy in the United States is moribund,
right,
while the parasitic financial culture continues to suck the lifeblood out of the United States' real economy. That's
right.
What's going on.
Yep.
Now, are Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Peru, Colombia, and Mexico, are the elites of those countries so irredeemably stupid that they're going to follow that model? Where do their best interests lie? And that's,
right,
you see, that's a question that I don't know the answer to that question, but it's an answer to it. It's a question that should be put. And it's by no means clear that, although people say, oh, well, the Pacific Alliance is an economic model that's going to recreate the free trade area of the Americas that was defeated back in 2003, well, or
right,
whatever it was, by the combination of Lula, and that's another reason why Lula has been put in jail.
For sure.
Lula, Nestor Kirchner, and Hugo Chavez, whom
right,
I'm convinced that the United States intelligence services
killed.
But, and Nestor Kirchner, of course, died some years ago. And that, is that the case? under the new circumstances that Cristina Kirchner, or Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and Rafael Correa have recently been talking about in a very interesting interview that I think you also saw on RT. Yeah. And it's very telling that these kinds of real discussions about what is really going on in the world don't happen in Western media.
That's right.
They happen in other media.
Right.
And I think Bruno Scarsini's article is largely correct, but I think he underplays the uncertainty at a global level around what is going to happen with global trade and what kind of Pacific Alliance, what kind of free trade arrangements, free trade, of course, arrangements are going to actually finally be agreed between the Pacific countries that are now operating in a framework that is not dominated by the United States, although it may have very strong influence from major multinational US corporations, but is in practice is absolutely subjugated, as it were, to what China and the Eurasian Economic Area, the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, all these institutions that have been built up in the Eurasian bloc. And it's a complete fantasy to suggest that Latin America is somehow going to be isolated from all that, or that the elites in Latin America are somehow going to say, oh, we'd rather forego all kinds of opportunities that are coming up in Asia because we want to be loyal to the United States. Do people really believe that?
Well, that goes to the question of their intent as an elite, but then there's also the question of the material reality, which is no matter what they intend, it may be that it seems likely the circumstances won't allow them to do it, even as they steer the wheel that way. We saw accommodation of that reality as policy implemented by Hugo Chavez, for example, saying to countries like Colombia and other right-wing governments, look, we'll do business with you too. Keep your system however you want. And here's some incentives if you want to invest in your own people, period. And leaders there engaged at that level because the benefits to their own population were so substantial that if they ignored it, the people themselves would say, hey, where's my share of that?
Yeah. Now, something that Bruno wrote in his article is definitely the case in that he explains in his article, and I think he's absolutely right, that the reason that people went after Lula, the Brazilian elites went after Lula, or rather the Brazilian elites' leading economic interests in Brazil that do not affect United States corporate interests in Brazil. For example, the soya industry,
right.
the agro industry, right. Mining interests.
The ones with their own interests that are being pursued, right?
So what Bruno's saying is that it was those elements among the Brazilian elite that went after Lula. And that also explains why they went after Eduardo da Cunha. Because Eduardo da Cunha, he was the right-wing mastermind that pushed through, with all the political connections, that pushed through the soft coup against Dilma. But he ended up getting sent to jail, just like Lula. Now, why?
Right.
Because Lula and da Cunha, whatever their political opposition, the political contradictions between them, they both promoted the idea that Brazil's corporate elites should operate in a nationalistic way and not subordinate themselves to the interests of U.S. corporations.
Right. They're the local competitors to the global corporations. They ally with the global corporations to take out the Socialists or the Workers' Party or whatever, and then they get taken out by U.S. corporations.
Yeah, and that of course is the very essence of the U.S. campaign against Venezuela.
Yep.
So, should we start talking about Venezuela?
Yeah, we got to go there. Yeah, we've got about 7 minutes, so let's go
okay.
there.
So, and if you look at Venezuela, what's now happening there looks as though there's the presidential election's on May the 22nd. One of the main factors that is going to influence the way voters go in that presidential election is, of course, the fundamental economic question of how they view the Venezuela's economy, given the fact that everyone in Venezuela, or certainly the great majority of people who are eligible to vote in those presidential elections, understand that Venezuela is at war with the United States, and that the United States is imposing all kinds of economic sanctions that affect their ability to live a normal life.
Right.
So the question there, and now last year, we saw that in the elections for the Constituent Assembly, in the elections for the regional governorships, in the elections for the municipal authorities, in all those three elections, a great majority of the Venezuelan people supported the current Venezuelan authorities led by President Nicolas Maduro. Now, the challenge for the United States and its regional allies was, well, can we intensify the economic war against Venezuela to the extent that we can reverse that support for the Venezuelan government led by Nicolas Maduro? And all the signs are that they can't, because the Venezuelan authorities have managed to consolidate and even extend the support for low-income families suffering from the effects of the economic warfare of the United States. They've set up successfully, and incredibly, in my opinion, and what an incredible time scale that they managed to set up this alternative cryptocurrency called the Petro, which is the equivalent of issuing a national currency that is completely independent of the US dollar,
right,
for domestic purposes. Now, that is slowly beginning to have an effect, because Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues in the Venezuelan government have told all Venezuelan government authorities that receive any kind of income for services that the government provides to charge those services in Petro, not in Bolivars.
Right.
In Bolivars converted to the Petro, and so the dollar becomes completely irrelevant, at least for those transactions between the government and the Venezuelan public. So, and there's that. There's also, and a practical example of that, for example, is that all the shipping companies that operate in Venezuela's various ports are obliged to use the Petro. And so that has a tremendous effect on...
Yeah, all the downstream prices, for sure. Everything. It comes through shipping, and now it goes through, goes out into the economy, and it's already been, purged of the dollar.
Yeah, so as that process advances and consolidates itself, running up to May, the question, the presidential elections in May, the question then is, what is the United States going to do around the election, and what are they going to do if and when, as I suspect will happen, Nicolas Maduro wins those elections, and also, perhaps as important, that the United Socialist Party of Venezuela does much better in the legislative elections than they did back in 2015. Because I think those elections, although they're separate elections, I think they're also scheduled for May. I'm not sure of the date. But we'll see. So what is the United States going to do? And I fear that once they realize that Maduro is likely to win those elections, what will happen is that Henry Falcón, the leading opposition presidential candidate, will say, well, the conditions don't exist for a free and fair election, and he'll retire. And then, if he does that, then all he'll be doing is ratifying a result that would have happened anyway, whether he participated or not. But the important thing about that is that Falcon now has the support of the more important Venezuelan opposition parties like Justice First, Primera Justicia, and Popular Will, Voluntad Popular. Why does he have that support? Because the United States has told their Venezuelan subordinates to support Henry Falcon, who is the leading opposition presidential candidate. And why would they do that? Because they want to have control or some level of influence over Falcon's campaign.
Yep.
And the fact that Falcon has agreed to that suggests that he is amenable to stringing along with orders from the United States State Department.
And, you know, the context for all of this going into the election, by the way, is all of the levers have already been set for the U.S. to say this election was not legitimate. It's been declared that already by the Jordanian prince, Zaid, who's the current UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. He, the Lima Group, a whole bunch of others, all these different, essentially, tools of the United States have already said that the election is illegitimate and blah, blah, blah. And Venezuela conducts perhaps the most open elections and most democratic elections in the world.
Yeah, and the Carter Center has been saying that for years. Yep. But one of the aspects that is most astonishing and just gives a sign of how strong U.S. Coercion is in the international system is that the United Nations has refused to send election observers, despite being invited by Venezuelan authorities.
Which says everything that you need to say about it. Thank you, Tony. We're going to have to pick it up there next week. And we're going to keep a close eye on all of these things as they develop, because it looks like the future, at least the short-term or medium-term future of the region is back in play. So thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome, Don. Look forward to talking to you next time.
The same. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar. Another claim of another use of chemical weapons by Syria's government was brought before the UN Security Council by the U.S. and its allies Monday. Two of the UN's experts made presentations to the Council. Neither presented any hard evidence that any chemical weapons had been used, let alone proving who had used any. We bring you now all of the commentary from the various representatives of the various countries, beginning with the permanent representative of the Russian Federation, Vasily Nabenzia.
Thank you, sir. Sir, if you believe it is a great pleasure for me to speak about the issue that we will talk about now, to make a statement on the side, then you are mistaken. But unfortunately, the situation is such that I will have to state a great deal today, and it will be incumbent upon you to listen to what I have to say. We are grateful to Mr. Demistour for his briefing, as well as to Mr. Markram. The Russian Federation demanded called for this meeting to be held on the agenda item threats to international peace and security. Insofar as we are deeply alarmed at the fact that in a number of capitals, above all in Washington, and those blindly following it, London and Paris, there was a deliberate policy undertaken to stoke international tensions. The leadership of the United States, of the United Kingdom, and of France, without any justifications and without considering the consequences, have engaged in a confrontational policy against Russia and Syria, and they are prompting others to follow suit. A broad arsenal of methods is being leveraged: slander, insults, hawkish rhetoric, blackmail, sanctions, and threats to use force against the sovereign state. Well, Russia is being unpardonably threatened. The tone with which this is being done has gone beyond the threshold of what is acceptable, even during the Cold War. Such boorishness against my country is something which your predecessors did not take the liberty to undertake. What is next? We recall a rhetorical question which the Russian president put forward in 2015 from the United Nations General Assembly to our Western partners, above all the United States, concerning their reckless geopolitical experiments in the Middle East. Do you understand now what you have done? And the response at that time hung in the air. But there is a response. No, you do not understand. Just as you fail to understand what you are doing now. The lack of a clear strategy on any issue is appalling not just to us. It confounds not only us. This is confounding to the majority of those seated here. But they have decided not to openly put this forward to you. Following you, everywhere you go, regardless of everything you touch, chaos is left behind. In the brackish waters of which you try to take out fish something. But only mutant fish are being taken out. I will put another rhetorical question forward. Do you understand the dangerous threshold towards which you are bringing the world? One of the areas where there's hostility that is most stark, that is on Syria. The terrorists and extremists supported by external sponsors are enduring a defeat there. Let us recall that we are talking about those terrorists and extremists who you supplied, financed, and deployed in the country to oust a legitimate government. And now it is clear why this is causing hysteria among those who invested political and material capital in these dark forces. Recently, thanks to the efforts undertaken by Russia, in line with the implementation of Security Council resolutions, a large-scale operation has been undertaken to lift the siege of Eastern Ghouta. Its residents, for a number of years, were forced to endure the mockery and torture of fighters. More than 150,000 civilians were evacuated from that Damascus suburb, purely voluntarily, with the requisite security conditions being provided. Tens of thousands of them have already been able to return to the liberated areas, and many met with their relatives. There has been no change in democratic composition, which is being shouted about by supporters of the Syrian opposition, has occurred. These are lies. With the leaders of armed groups, there were difficult negotiations that took place. As a result, many of them left the areas they had occupied with full respect for guarantees for their safety. Incidentally, during these transportation operations, several attempts were undertaken to stage terrorist attacks when the militants attempted to reach the buses with the Shaheed belts. Other preferred to settle their status with the Syrian authorities. Thanks to presidential amnesty, they now will be able to return to civilian life, and subsequently, it is possible they may enter the Syrian security forces. We're talking about implementation of a UN principle, demobilization, disarmament, and reintegration. However, this is positive dynamic is not to the liking of some. Foreign sponsors through Western countries were willing to take up any straw just to maintain a hotbed of terrorist resistance at a striking distance from the Syrian capital. This for the fighters to continue to terrorize ordinary civilians, to seize their food, and to request from the international to beg of the international community that humanitarian assistance be delivered. Incidentally, they were not prepared to share medicine with ordinary civilians, as was shown in the inspection of the strongholds left behind by the fighters. As was the case in the past in eastern Aleppo, improvised hospital facilities in basements were full of medicine, which, as a result of sanctions, Western sanctions, were not provided to Damascus and other government controlled areas. Also, large storage heights were found, as were the bodies, the corpses of people who had been subjected to torture. We are stunned at the scale of the tunnels that were being used by jihadists. In some of them, small trucks were able to freely move about. These surprising underground facilities brought together the positions of groups who were viewed by some as moderate, and they were linked to the strongholds of Jabhat al-Nusra. On 6 April, the new head of Jaish al-Islam, following instructions of sponsors, derailed the evacuation of the 4th party of fighters from Duma and resumed the rocket and mortar firing against residential areas in Damascus. The firing targeted Meze 86, Ish al-Vurur, Abu Rumana, and Umayyad. According to official information, 8 died, 37 civilians were wounded. Unfortunately, we failed to see statements from Western capitals condemning the shelling of a historical district of Damascus. The following day, 7 April, fighters accused the Syrian authorities of dropping barrel bombs with toxic substances. At the same time, the versions were being mixed up. It was either called sarin, times chlorine, or at times a mix of toxic gases. Based on a well-known scheme, these rumors were immediately taken up by those financed by Western capitals. I'm referring to NGOs and the white helmets who are mendaciously acting under the cloak of health professionals. And these reports were also taken up and transferred to media outlets. It behooves us once again to state that many of these dubious opposition structures have a clear list of the email addresses of representatives of Security Council members, which shows that some of our colleagues with a reckless approach towards their status are leaking sensitive information to their protégés. Incidentally, all should recall the way that accidentally the white helmets put on the internet and a video which showed preparation for staging a so-called victim of an alleged attack perpetrated by the Syrian army. In 2011, the chemical serial began, and this continues to be shown to us with the calculation for each new episode to be more resonant than the one prior to it. In Washington, London, and Paris, immediate conclusions were drawn, pinning blame on the Syrian authorities, or, as they call it, the regime. Has nobody put the question to themselves, why does Damascus need this? There were insults against the Syrian government. However, the Syrian leadership. However, the main burden of responsibility was pinned on Russia and Iran, and I think that this is hardly surprising to anybody at this point. Now this has been done based on current trends immediately without any investigation being conducted. On 8 April, the Syrian troops sweeping through Al-Shimuna near Duma found a homemade manufacturing area of Jaish al-Islam to manufacture chemical substances artisanally. Chlorine agents of German manufacture and special equipment were also discovered. In Istanbul, an opposition journalist, Asad Hamid, who is based, put on his Twitter page a video allegedly from the area of the incident. This has probably from the white helmets. An unknown individual is next to a handmade bomb with a chemical which allegedly struck the bedroom of a building in Duma. All of this is was accompanied by comments about another attack by the regime against civilians. The staged nature of this action is something of which there's no doubt. The trajectory of the alleged trajectory of the bombs is unnatural. This entered fell through a roof and naturally, calmly fell into a bed without damaging that bed. A wooden bed without damaging the wooden bed. Clearly was placed there prior to preparation for the staging. And there's an interesting coincidence. The chemical provocation in Duma on Saturday, 7 April, occurred immediately after the U.S. delegation at the Security Council received instructions to convene for today, Monday, 9 April, to convene expert-level consultations on their draft resolution on the mechanism to investigate incidents with chemical weapons. The initial text today has far-reaching changes and revisions.
Under these obscure circumstances,
of course, we need to get to the bottom of what is taking place. However, we need to do so in an honest, objective, impartial way without disregarding the principle of presumption of innocence and by no means prejudging the outcome of the investigation. Despite the provocations, the Russian specialists continued their efforts to resolve the situation in eastern Ghouta. In afternoon, 8 April, Sunday, following a new agreement that was reached, the evacuation of Jaish al-Islam fighters resumed. Following the liberation of Duma from fighters, Russian specialists were sent there, specialists on radiological, chemical, and biological protection to collect evidence and information. They took soil samples, which showed the lack of nerve agent and chlorine-containing substances. Locals were interviewed about the cessation of resistance to the fighters. Not a single local resident confirmed the chemical attack having taken place. A local hospital, there were no reports about symptoms from a toxic substance such as chlorine. Other medical facilities are not located in Duma. The bodies of the dead as a result of contamination were not found. Medical personnel and residents have no information about their potential burial areas. Thereby, the use of sarin and chlorine is not confirmed. Incidentally, the representatives of the Syrian Red Crescent refuted the statement allegedly made on their behalf on the delivery of assistance to victims of toxic gas. I call upon those who will speak against me slandering the regime to proceed from the premise that there was no chemical weapons attack. Sweden drew up a draft resolution to investigate the incident. In principle, in order to conduct an investigation, OPCW needs no resolution. However, we are willing to consider this resolution. Today, we propose that what you envisage in your project, in your draft, be done. Let the OPCW, which through the Director General of the Technical Secretariat, Mr. Zumduk, stated a willingness to get to the bottom of what took place, let it immediately, tomorrow, fly to Damascus.
There,
the Syrian authorities and Russian troops will provide conditions to travel to the area of the alleged incident for them to familiarize themselves with the situation. Incidentally, this is what President Trump and other Western leaders called upon us to undertake. As for the possibility of a chemical attack being a possibility, this was repeatedly warned about by the Syrians at the Russian Center for the Reconciliation of Opposing Sides. It was stated that in order to take a film of a chemical attack, and I put this in quotes, the necessary equipment has already been brought in. We, too, made the relevant statements of the Security Council. You've heard these warnings. You've heard, but deliberately ignored. ignore them insofar as they do not align with the doctrinal views of those who sleep with and see in the elimination of a legitimate government in another Arab country. Still, what is not being looked into is the fact that a significant number of chemical weapons were discovered November-December 2017 in Syrian territory that had been liberated from fighters at terrorist storage sites in Zakhariya and Al-Wafir in Hama province. 21-ton containers were discovered. More than 50 munitions were found, which contained toxic chemicals. In Tel Adli, Idlib province, 24 tons of toxic chemicals were discovered, and this is believed to be chlorine. At the storage site in Мадамия, 30 kilometers northeast of Damascus, 240-160-millimeter caliber munitions were found. Plastic canisters were found with phosphorus. With phosphorus substances and compounds. In the area of Asarita, Idlib province, an industrial complex was found for the synthesis of various toxic substances. 54 chemical munitions were found, with 44 chemical containers were found, and these could be used for the manufacture of toxic substances. From the beginning of this year alone, four instances were reported of fighters using toxic chemicals from against positions where government troops are located in Sudja and El-Mshaif. More than 100 Syrian troops were hospitalized. 3 March, when Hazrama and Aftris were liberated in eastern Ghouta, fighters from government troops discovered in a tunnel an underground artisanal manufacturing site to make chemical munitions of a handmade nature. And this is far from a full list. It points to the wrongdoings and abuses by the irreconcilable opposition. However, the OPCW's experts being sent there to identify evidence is not something which we see people eager to do. We demand that OPCW verify all of those areas. Access can be provided. Also, information is surfacing that at Tanf, the camp, American instructors trained a number of groups of fighters to stage provocations with chemical weapons used to create a pretext for a strike. It was clear to us that the attempt to shelter terrorists and at the same time to punish the regime so hated by some Western capitals will sooner or later be undertaken. Speaking heads on television screens sought to repeat last year's attack against Syria. Last year's strike, this morning, there were strikes, missile strikes, against the Tifor airfield in Homs province. We are deeply troubled by such actions. Provocations in Duma echo last year's incident in Han Shihun. The unifying moment aspect is the fact that there's a planned nature of these attacks. Analysis of the U.S.'s operations prior to and after the incident in Han Shihun in April 2016 shows that Washington, ahead of time, prepared for its operation. The U.S. Porter and Ross naval destroyers from 4 to 7 April last year, that is when the toxic substance was used in Han Shihun before the strike against the Sharat airbase, were already present in the Mediterranean waters where they were engaged in planned operations. They did not enter the ports where an exchange of munitions could have been taken place by increasing the number of cruise missiles. Inter alia, 4 to 5 April, the Porter and destroyer was located southeast of Sicily, and the Ross naval destroyer was in passage from the Rota naval base in the area more south of Sardinia. Later, 6 April, an expedited movement of both naval destroyers was reported in the firing positions more southwest of Cyprus. From there, on 7 April, they conducted a mass strike against the Shirat airfield. At the same time, the number of Tomahawk missiles that were launched, 59 units, surpassed the overall munitions for two naval destroyers if they had actually been engaged in the anti-missile defense operations that had been assigned to them. And for that purpose, only 48 units were necessary. Thereby, U.S. naval vessels, even prior to the chemical incident in Han Sheikhuna, entered military service with strike, fit for strike equipment that is an increase of cruise missiles that were more than that were necessary for the anti-missile defense. And this could attest to prior planning by Washington of an act, a strike against Damascus. The fake news on Saturday from Duma are geared inter alia towards drawing attention of society away from the Skripal case, which was muddled up by London, and pooling and throwing on Russia completely unconfirmed accusations, and with the aim of pooling solidarity to build an anti-Russian alliance. Now the English are stepping away from a transparent investigation and putting forward specific responses for the questions put, and at the same time they are sweeping up their tracks. During the Security Council meeting 5 April on the Skripal case, we cautioned that an attempt to unjustifiably place blame on us of having had a hand in the Salisbury incident was linked to the Syrian chemical dossier. Yesterday, this issue saw new interesting developments. For the moment, the UK Foreign Minister Boris Johnson continues to disclose the things against Russia and attempt to be witty, and here is the following pearl. Experts of a British naval expert south of Cyprus intercepted on the day of Skripal's poisoning, intercepted reports from Damascus suburbs to Moscow, and this is what Times is reporting. It contains the following sentence. The phrase, the message has been delivered. The parcel has been delivered, and two individuals successfully left. This turns out to be part of the intelligence information provided by London to allies prior to the expulsion of Russian diplomats. However, is it not clear that there's an irrefutable link here? Is that not clear to all? Syria, Russia, Salisbury. I would hint to the British intelligence services, and I will do so without charge. Another powerful course. Why not propose that Novichok, which is so light now, was reached Salisbury directly from Syria by a parcel to cover up their tracks? This is complete mockery here. Ambassador Haley recently stated that Russia will never be a friend of the United States. And I wish to respond to that. Friendship is something which is both reciprocal and voluntary. One cannot force a friendship. And we are not particularly keen to be friends with you. We are not begging to be friends with you. Well, what we want from you is really nothing. Something that is normal, civilized relations, which you arrogantly refuse, disregarding elementary courtesy, basic courtesies. And you're misguided if you think that you have friends. You have so-called friends of yours are only those who cannot say no to you, and this is the sole criterion for friendship in your understanding. Russia has friends, and unlike yourselves, we do not have adversaries.
Мы через такую призму на мир не смотрим.
We do not view the world through that prism.
Международный терроризм — это, да,
and
наш враг.
Yes, international terrorism, that is our enemy.
Но мы по-прежнему
However, we continue to propose cooperation. This needs to be respectful and mutual cooperation. It needs to be geared towards resolving real, not imagined problems. And you should be equally interested, equally as interested
концов,
as we are in such cooperation. Ultimately, as permanent members of the Security Council, we bear the main responsibility for the maintenance of international peace and security.
Based
through the relevant channels, we already conveyed to the U.S. that armed force under mendacious pretext against Syria, where at the request of the legitimate government of the country, Russian troops have been deployed, could lead to grave repercussions. We call upon Western politicians to scale down their hawkish rhetoric to meaningfully consider possible repercussions and to cease the reckless spillover of threats to global security. What military misadventures of the West bring about are well known to us if we consider the examples of Yugoslavia, Iraq, and Libya. And nobody has vested you with the power to act as gendarmes, as policemen of the world, and at the same time to act both as investigators, procurators, judges, and executioners.
Призываем вернуться в правовое
We
поле,
call for you return to the legal fold to comply with the UN Charter and to jointly tackle problems that arise rather than attempting at each step to advance your egotistical geopolitical
games.
All of the energy needs to be focused on support for the political process in Syria, to which end it is necessary to constructively pool the efforts of all influential players. Russia always stands ready to engage in such cooperation. To conclude, Mr. President, I wish to take this opportunity to request an open briefing of the Security Council on the outcomes of the UN assessment mission in Raqqa and the situation in the Rukban camp.
As members of,
we see the way members of the Commission attempting to create a smokescreen around this issue, which is a result of their actions in Syria, including the operation to raise Raqqa to the ground through the bombings. No chemical provocations will detract attention from what you have done. Thank you.
I thank the representative of the Russian Federation for his statement.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.